Imagine just for a moment how it might seem if, at the height of the Iraq War, filmmakers like Steven Spielberg and Martin Scorsese had decided to put their careers on hold, enlist in the armed forces, and make movies to help the government's cause. That's just what happened during World War II when some of the film industry's most honored directors, John Ford, William Wyler, John Huston, Frank Capra, and George Stevens, turned their backs on Hollywood to enlist in the war effort. And in Five Came Back, Mark Harris, his new book for Penguin, explains how all of them, as a result, Hollywood itself, were changed. I'm pleased to welcome Mark Harris back to our show. Hi.
Hi, thanks.
Was World War II the first time Hollywood cooperated with the U.S. government?
You know, even in the silent era, Hollywood had done a little bit, but not in concert with the government. This was the first time there was a real effort to, you know, pull together a war program of films, although they really winged it once the war started.
Well, Wings actually was a film that was made with the help of the U.S. War Department, I think it was called then. But the no directors went and helped the war effort during World War One.
Well, of course, you know, the U.S. got into World War One late, and the film industry was still really in its infancy. I mean, it was 1917 when the U.S. got in, and that was the sort of middle period of the silent era. So there was less, in a way, that Hollywood could do than when World War II came around.
And then, but they did make a number of movies glorifying the war effort after World War I. In this case, something else was going on. Were these seen as documentaries or as propaganda films?
Both. And that was a really constant and complicated question when the directors went to war, whether they were there to document, to almost serve as journalists abroad bringing the war back home, or whether they were in the army to serve the army's interests.
Was it possible to work on these films without enlisting?
Yeah, it was possible. I mean, screenwriters in particular were sometimes brought to Washington, D.C. for a week or two or a month to work on scripts for the movies. But these directors, the five I'm talking about, all went into the Army or the Navy, in John Ford's case, for between 3 and 4 years.
The Signal Corps?
Yeah, there were jurisdictional issues, but the Signal Corps basically oversaw all of it.
Now, you focus on five directors. John Ford, William Wyler, and Frank Capra were probably among the most respected filmmakers of the time. What about John Huston and George Stevens?
Well, John Huston was younger and newer in Hollywood than the other directors I wrote about. He had been a pretty successful screenwriter for the few years before the war started, but his first movie as a director, The Maltese Falcon, had just come out before Pearl Harbor.
But that was a hit, wasn't it?
It was a huge hit, and he was really well on his way to becoming a major director, and honestly not in any particular hurry to get into the Army.
Were any of these people friends?
Wyler and Huston were actually best friends. They were playing tennis at Wyler's house when the news of Pearl Harbor broke.
So did they encourage each other to get involved?
Oh, yeah. According to Wyler, the two of them had been planning a trip to China that they were scheduled to meet with another director friend of theirs, Anatole Litvak, to go plan a trip to China. And by that afternoon, they had just thrown away the idea completely. And the only question was, how could they get officers' commissions and how quickly?
Are those the kinds of projects that they gave up to enlist? Were any of them working on film projects?
Oh, they were all in the middle of very active careers in Hollywood. And, you know, except for John Ford, who actually went into the Navy 3 months before Pearl Harbor, it wasn't as if they could jump in right on December 8th. They had movies to wrap up. Huston, in fact, ended up having to hand off the last few days of shooting on one of his movies to another director so that he could go.
John Ford had to have been fairly old if he joined before Pearl Harbor. He was a major director during the silent era.
Right. I mean, all of these directors were, quote-unquote, too old to go into
World War II. But why would Ford have enlisted before Pearl Harbor? Did he feel war was imminent, or was
he actually did feel war was imminent. When a lot of his colleagues in Hollywood and when a lot of Americans were saying, oh, we really don't know what's going to happen, it looks bad, Ford was fairly certain that war was inevitable.
Did they have to join? They were all, as you say, older, 30s and up.
Right. They did not have to join. I think Houston was actually young enough to be eligible for the draft, but could have gotten a health exemption. This was all voluntary, and Ford actually was so old that he technically could have served in the First World War.
Now, did they all join out of patriotic reasons, the reason that many people enlisted after 9/11?
I think patriotism was certainly a part of it for all of them, but there were other elements. They were all men with very healthy egos. Ford wanted to run his own division. Capper wanted to prove that he wasn't just an immigrant, that he was a true blue American. Houston wanted an adventure.
We actually have two people who were born overseas.
Yes. William Wyler was born in a town called Mulhouse, part of Alsace, that was French or German, literally depending on the month.
And he was a German citizen. Was Capra born an Italian citizen?
Capra was Sicilian, and he was brought to America when he was very, very young by his parents. He was a naturalized American, but his older sister was not, and was actually listed as a potential alien when the war started.
And that's interesting, considering what we're discussing these days. Frank Capra's sister today might very well have been deported.
Right, that's quite possible.
Now, you mentioned Ford went into the Navy to make educational films?
It was more than to make educational films. He had the idea, really before the Navy did, that the war would need experienced filmmakers to document it. And he volunteered to pull together a crew of sound men and cameramen in Hollywood and train them.
So the United States was already planning for a war? There was a war going on in Europe.
Right.
But we were kind of dragged into the war, weren't we?
Well,
on Pearl Harbor?
There was a huge isolationist wing up until very late 1941 that insisted that we should stay out of it. And that those isolationists, by the way, were also violently anti-Hollywood.
Did any of these guys come close to real action?
Yes, they did. Ford was on the roof of a power station filming the Battle of Midway as Zeros flew over his head and was actually hit by shrapnel. Wyler went on bombing runs over occupied France and Germany.
Now, hit by shrapnel, I imagine that would have a lifetime impact on him.
It was actually a fairly small wound that he made the most of.
I mean, psychologically.
Yeah. For Ford, war was really a test of personal courage, which was something that he always had great doubts about within himself.
Didn't he win two Oscars during the war?
It's funny, they were all incredibly competitive about the Oscars before the war, and during the war, their Oscar competitiveness just shifted over to the documentary categories.
Wyler joined the Air Force, and what kind of action did he see?
Wyler was posted to England and then to Bassingbourne Air Force Base just outside of London, and he went on 5 bombing runs, one of which inspired his very famous documentary, The Memphis Belle.
Well, many people thought of Hollywood as being a Jewish enclave, but he's the only Jewish director in this group of 5.
That's right. The men who ran the studios were for the most part Jewish, but these directors were quite a mix. Ford was Irish, Capra was Sicilian.
George Stevens was whatever.
George Stevens was sort of an all-American. He was a California kid whose father had been in show business.
Now, Wyler had just made Mrs. Miniver, which earned him an Oscar. Later, he said he thought it was a little too soft. But he didn't win an Oscar for his best war film, the one you just mentioned, The Memphis Belle. Still, had Americans seen anything comparable up to this point?
No, Wyler was really a stickler for accuracy, and the footage in Memphis Belle was filmed by him and 2 of his crewmen on actual bombing runs. They recreated the soundtrack because they had to, but even that soundtrack was recreated using the original crew of the Belle.
And this was shown right after the war started?
No, it was shown in, I think, 43 or 44, a little deeper into the war.
Did American audiences respond positively?
Absolutely. I mean,
because this is more than newsreel footage.
It's more than newsreel footage. And in fact, the directors often fought to keep their footage out of newsreels because they didn't want all of their best stuff poached for, you know, other filmmakers.
Was he at all hurt during the shooting?
Wyler was not hurt during the shooting of Memphis Belle, but when he was making a subsequent Air Force documentary called Thunderbolt, he was filming some footage of the Italian coast and got out of the plane and was struck deaf and never regained his hearing.
Wow. That must have affected him as a director.
Yeah, it affected him as a director, and it shattered him as a person. His war service was literally finished and done overnight, and he had to go home. He didn't know if he would ever direct again.
But he did. He directed some pretty famous films, including the most famous of the post-war films.
Yes, he directed The Best Years of Our Lives, which is a story of three returning veterans, each of whom, in a different way, was representative of an aspect of Wyler's own life and personality.
My guest is Mark Harris, whose latest book is Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War, looking at John Ford, George Stevens, John Huston, William Wyler, and Frank Capra, and the films that they made during the war. Capra joined the Army 4 days after Pearl Harbor and seemed more aware of how film could be used as propaganda than the other directors that you are writing about.
He really was more aware of it, and he was also more aware of it than the War Department itself. The whole war program of films, the Why We Fight documentaries, and dozens of other movies that Capra oversaw were really his idea, not the Army's.
He had been scared to death, he said, by Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will. So I guess he was thinking, I better do something that would be the American counterpart of that.
Yes, and his fear of Triumph of the Will actually led to a kind of creative breakthrough, which is that since he had almost no money to make these propaganda movies, he realized that he could use enemy propaganda footage to show just how dangerous their thinking was.
So he never went out of the country. He did pretty much all of the work in Queens, New York.
He worked a lot in Washington, D.C., and there was a big Army facility in Astoria. He did go to London at one point to supervise the making of a really ill-fated Anglo-American joint venture.
And how was Why We Fight received? It's a seven-parter.
It's a seven-parter. Each of the movies is about an hour long. And Why We Fight was never intended for public consumption. It was made to replace these really boring lectures that incoming GIs were falling asleep during. And it was received fantastically by incoming soldiers. Capra really fought to get the movies into theaters because, in part, he was jealous of his colleagues whose movies were in theaters. Three of the seven Why We Fight films opened, and they didn't do much business. The public was not as interested as soldiers were.
George Stevens was probably the least well-known at the time.
That's right.
Although he had a pretty incredible career.
Now we revere those pre-war movies he made, things like Swing Time with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers and Gunga Din. He was a successful director, but I think he was seen as something of a lightweight. He made mostly escapist movies and comedies.
He was making More the Merrier when the war started.
Right, which is one of the best of the wartime comedies. He finished it, previewed it, and left the next day.
And then he shot some of the most powerful footage.
Yes. Stevens was the last into the war and the last out of the war. He was also the first into the camps. He filmed the very, very famous footage of Dachau that we still see and that, in fact, was used as evidence in the Nuremberg trials.
And it was named to the National Film Registry.
That's right. It's all preserved at the Library of Congress now.
John Huston had, as you said, just started getting notice as a director of Maltese Falcon when he joined the Signal Corps. He covered a lot more ground than the other four directors.
You know, among the four of them, they were just about everywhere, but Huston had a pretty extraordinary experience. He started in the Aleutians for his first documentary on a remote air base. Then he was in the thick of the Italian campaign, where he made another movie. And his third movie, which he made back in the United States, was about psychologically scarred returning veterans.
And the Army almost wasn't going to release that?
They didn't release it.
The Battle of San Pietro?
Oh, well, yes. The Battle of San Pietro.
Oh, the Let There Be Light. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the Battle of San Pietro is a fascinating story because it was entirely restaged. Houston got there too late for the actual battle, and the army essentially told him to fake it, which he did, but he faked it in a way that made it look more realistic than any previous war film. So much so that there were factions in the army that thought maybe it was too brutal and too upsetting for Americans to see.
So he had problems with all the films that he did. The Battle of San Pietro, Let There Be Light, and even Report from the Aleutians. What was the problem there?
Houston got involved in a kind of turf war with this man named Lowell Mellett, who was one of the liaisons between Hollywood and Washington who was overseeing these films. That was a fight over length, a fight that directors still have now. There were people who thought a 16-minute version of the film should go out. Houston wanted it longer.
Did they ever talk about working for the War Department as compared to working for the Hollywood moguls? Which one was worse?
I think Capra found that they were about the same, and he actually felt that he and Wyler both felt that their experience in fighting against studio heads to preserve their own vision served them very, very well when it came time to deal with, you know, the War Department.
Were they doing the same sort of thing here that we now expect from television news?
You could say that they were early versions of embeds in a way, but they were also in some ways given a freer hand. There was less of an army bureaucracy to tell them where they could and couldn't go and what they could and couldn't film.
Since they all, most of them anyway, saw some pretty horrific things, did it have an effect on them? Well, one of them went deaf, as you say. Do we see any PTSD here?
I think we absolutely did. Of course, it wasn't called PTSD back in the early 1940s, but John Houston was certainly very, very traumatized by what he saw in Italy. He later said that when he came back to New York, and this was still during the war, he would load his service revolver and walk into Central Park at night, hoping that he could find somebody to shoot. And Stevens was also really, really shattered by what he saw at Dachau.
Well, Let There Be Light, it deals with PTSD, or what was then called shell shock.
Right. One of Houston's very closest associates, a cameraman named Ray Scott, whom he had worked with on the Aleutians movie, essentially had a nervous breakdown when he came back. And that made Houston interested in doing this movie.
Do we see their war experiences reflected in the movies that they made after the war? John Ford makes My Darling Clementine.
I think, you know, it's funny because you think of Ford after the war and you think of a whole series of Westerns that he made.
The
Ford
Searcher.
Apache, The Searcher, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. I think you do see in Ford a deep reverence for the nobility of lost causes, for the heroism of the individual over the sort of glory seeking of the commander. That's absolutely a part of his war experience being reflected.
John Houston made The Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Right. To me, in Houston, what you see is a kind of cynicism about authority that lasted for decades in his movies.
And then later he made an anti-war film, The Red Badge of Courage, although interestingly, it starred a war hero, Audie Murphy.
Yes. None of the directors were moved after the war to make gung-ho, enthusiastic war films. Stevens certainly was not.
Capra, didn't he make It's a Wonderful Life after the war?
Capra made It's a Wonderful Life right after the war. It was really the last movie of any note he made in his career, although he lived for decades more and made a handful of other movies. And that was really, you know, the whole premise of It's a Wonderful Life, what would the world have been like if I had never been born, was more a reflection of Capra's insecurity about going back to Hollywood and his feeling that he had been forgotten there.
Also, wouldn't it be if we hadn't fought the Nazis, this world would have been lost?
Yes. Capra really viewed the war as an interruption rather than a world changer. And I think he thought truly to the end that when the war was over, everything would just go back to normal.
Now, Ford had only one eye, if I remember correctly. Oh, no, that was Hawks.
Hawks. But yeah. Ford had a bad eye and wore an eye patch for most of his later career.
And Wyler, you say, was essentially deaf, and yet he directed The Heiress. He directed The Sound of Music.
Robert Wise directed The Sound of Music.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right.
But no.
Oh, he'd been offered The Sound of Music and turned it down because
right.
he said, I just can't bear to make a picture about all those nice Nazis.
Yes, and in the sort of annals of what might have been in Hollywood, one of the last movies that Wyler could have made, but he just didn't think he had the strength to do it, was Patton.
He did do Ben-Hur.
He did.
I don't know if that in any way is connected to his war experience.
I don't think so. It's interesting that, you know, Ben-Hur is a giant movie, and Stephen's movies got longer and bigger, too. I think they wanted to take on big challenges after the war.
Well, Stephen's made I Remember Mama. It's almost a way of saying I don't want to think about the war.
It's true. It took Stevens a long time to get his feeling back after the war. I Remember Mama wasn't until 1948. But then he went on a sort of unparalleled run of big movies in the 50s, A Place in the Sun, Shane, Giant, The Diary of Anne Frank, that really made him, by the end of the 50s, the most respected American director.
Greatest story ever told.
But right,
do you think Diary of Anne Frank grows directly out of his experiences?
You know, it's funny. Of course, that would be a natural assumption that that would be his final grappling with the war. But Stevens always said that his real war movie was Shane, which he felt was about, you know, the cost of what a bullet can do.
Now, none of them tried to deal seriously with the wars that followed, Korea or Vietnam. Other directors did. Sam Fuller definitely made movies about Vietnam.
Right.
But do you think they were done with the war, or was that just something that they would hand off to the next generation?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter. You know, like many directors of their generation, like many men of their generation, World War II was the defining event of their lives.
So it changed them. What about Hollywood?
I think it certainly changed Hollywood. You can see it beginning in 1945 when Billy Wilder makes his drama about alcoholism, The Lost Weekend. And you see it continued the next year when Wyler makes The Best Years of Our Lives. Servicemen coming back raised a whole host of issues: alcoholism, spousal abuse, depression, reintegration into the workforce, mental illness, that were the furthest things from anything Hollywood would have dealt with before the war.
And I'm assuming that also relied on a response from audiences.
Yes. Audiences wanted more serious movies. That's why in some ways you see the growth not only of social realism but of film noir after the war, but also the directors who came back felt very, very strongly that they wanted more independence.
Well, this is kind of the beginning of the end of the studio system, although it took a while. But it's not the same after the war as it was before the war. Do you think it's because these directors saw themselves as more independent now?
You know, it's funny. In my first book, I wrote about the erosion of the studio system, the final collapse of it in the mid-1960s. But I do think that the very first roots of that can be found right after the war, when these directors wanted to cast off long-term contracts and do their own thing.
It is interesting that there was the Oscar competition, The Best Years of Our Lives versus It's a Wonderful Life.
Right. And, you know, It's a Wonderful Life is now known as this holiday classic, but it was not a hit when it came out, and it was not particularly warmly received by critics either. And, in fact, it didn't do well at the Oscars. The Best Years of Our Life beat it in every category.
Well, I always thought It's a Wonderful Life had an extra life, partly because it went into the public domain, and so people did not have to pay to show it on television for years.
Right. And it did. Television really brought it back to life. But at that moment in 1946 and 1947, audiences were hungry for something real.
Now, your previous book, Pictures of a Revolution, dealt with the 1967 Oscar nominees and how they defined the new Hollywood. But obviously you've thought now about going a little further back into Hollywood history.
I did. I wanted to go backwards rather than forward because I was conscious that war movies were something I had always avoided as a kid. I just stayed away from them, and I wanted to understand why I was hiding from them.
Did producers also get involved in the war?
Yeah, producers and studio executives. I mean, Daryl Zanuck, who ran Fox, was incredibly eager to get into the war. He wrote a book called Tunis Expeditions about his experiences there. And
And Mark Harris, who is the author of a number of books on film, his latest is Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War. It is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me.